Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Hey guys, certification roundup time. You know, I'm always preaching, go a little deeper in your practice and take some certifications. So I wanted to let you know, this year we have added so many more. But like usual, we have our teacher training, which is a great certification if you want to deepen your practice or you're looking to teach. We have Reiki certification at all levels. Our sound certification's been added. So if you want to learn how to play the bowls, that's for you. Akashic Records, both basic and advanced. And intuitive healing, which is always one of our more popular ones that we run a few times a year. Crystal certification being added, and a tarot reading certification. So please, if you're interested, go to denmeditation.com, go to certifications, check out the schedule, or you can email denteachertraining@denmeditation.com and we can answer any questions you have as well. But here's some good news. If you don't live in LA or you don't have the time to like come in at our schedule, a few of these are already on our denanywhere.com site and you can do them at your own leisure. So go to denanywhere.com, check out what we have there, and we're always adding as well. So I hope you join us this year and get certified. Welcome to Den Talks Podcast. This is Tal, your host and founder of Den Meditation. I have Megan Monahan on. I'm so excited to have her here. I've been wanting to talk to her for a long time. She is a meditation teacher. She's from Jersey, so you know I'm particularly excited about that. But what I love about it and the Jersey part that comes out is she's so grounded and she just tells it like it is. So we really kind of walk through some of the basics of meditation and why it's beneficial. I know conversations you've heard before, but she has such a great point of view and such a way that's going to make any of you that are still struggling to get a regular practice going, you might be trying. I think this will be kind of the information that'll help you get over the hump. She has a great new book out, Don't Hate Meditate, which we chat a lot about as well. I think you're going to love this episode. She is hilarious, really funny, really fun to listen to. And like I said, just blunt New Jersey, East Coast, which is such a great combination in the spiritual world. I hope you enjoy it. Take during.
I'm one of those people that's annoyingly sensitive to sound, so I try not to.
I
think I have
sensitive.
That disease, you know?
It's called,
irrational. No, there's a thing.
No, I have it.
Like the sound of people eating.
Chewing. I have it. I forget. My husband, boyfriend, it's the same person. I use both words. He sent it to me when we first started dating because his ex-girlfriend had it.
Yeah.
And he was like, I think you and Sarah both have this. Yeah. And he sent it to me and I was like, oh my God. And then I used to work with his ex a lot and I was like, Sarah, I have it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all, like, I can't hear people chewing gum. Like when that person emailed us about gum, like selling CBD gum here, I just wrote back, absolutely no gum in the studio. Like, I can't do it. I have to tell people I work with all the time. I'm like, I know it's irrational. I know it seems crazy. My poor nanny, it's the first thing she learned about me because she was chewing day one.
No.
And I'm like, oh, fuck, she doesn't know me at all. So this is what she's going to be now basing. And the first day I'd be like,
here's the thing.
I was like, I know it's crazy. I can't hear the gum. I don't like it. It makes me go nuts. I will sit here and probably stare through you.
You just have like homicidal
It's like an anger
thoughts.
Comes.
Yeah, it's so
And so I told her, I was like, so I need you not to chew around me. Yeah. And I laughed. I told Alec, I was like, you know she went home. I was like, my boss is fucking. Now, if that happened month three, she would have been like, okay, so she has a weird thing.
Right.
But day one, first
you
thing.
You had to be clear about that stuff.
I had to. I've learned because otherwise I will end up like passive aggressively hating on you.
Like if I'm with someone that I love dearly in my home, like eating and it's quiet, I have to put music on. Like I have to do something because the chewing gum
for me is the worst.
Gum,
it's like. And it got really bad in high school because that's when the test taking started and people would chew gum during tests. And it was like, oh my God, I used to take all my tests with my hands over my ears and then quickly to like answer the thing. Like, and then my hands would go up over my ears because all I would hear is like,
that's so funny.
And then if someone's like popping, snapping, oh my God, it's like literally the insides of my body. It's a physical reaction.
Yeah, it's bad. I had a sound guy one time. He said, you know, your voice is so great. You should think about doing those ASMR videos, you know, where it's like, so I'm going and it's.
Oh, yeah. No.
I was like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Under no circumstances.
I can't do that
to
anyone
else.
It's funny because my boyfriend started smoking again because he used to be a smoker, but not with me.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't telling me, even though I knew, because you always know when I asked him a million times and he lied. That was a whole other issue, but different conversation. But he started chewing gum. That was one of the things, because he was trying to, like, clear the thing.
You're like, honestly, I'd prefer the nicotine.
And I remember finally being like, I said a couple of things, and he made, like, a comment once. It was hilarious. This is the thing. You can't fuck with someone who's totally secure in themselves. He's like, whatever, you're so irrational. I'm like, No, I know it's irrational, and I know it's crazy, but I've also told you about it day one, so who's the issue? You who decided to start chewing gum 4 years into our relationship, or me who's been very clear about an issue she's had from day one? And he was like, I'm like, so stop it. Chew it, not around me. Like, but it was so funny because he was like trying to make me feel bad about it. I'm like, you can't make me feel bad about it. I know it's crazy.
You can't
touch us. But it is what it is, and I don't know what to tell you. So, like, it ain't changing, and it hasn't changed from 4 years ago. You're the one who decided to start chewing gum. And then once it came out that he's smoking, which I knew, I was like, yeah, I didn't date a smoker. I purposely wouldn't have dated a smoker, so you figure it
out.
You
changed the rules, I was like, not that's, me. I'm still playing the same game.
That's exactly what I said to him. I go, you changed the rules. No, I said exactly that. I was like, not me.
Yeah.
I was like, so you work around it. You figure it out.
And if you want to get back in my game, you let me know. Otherwise, like, go play that game with your rules. And
it was so funny because I remember that moment of being like, oh, don't put me being nutso about gum chewing when, like, you could have walked out day one. I was very clear about it.
So good.
And I was like, clearly it doesn't bother you because you dated another girl with this right before. I mean, his girlfriend before me was.
That's funny.
Oh, he's the one who told me what is it called?
It must be karmic for him.
Something is, well, it's funny. His mom is a throat clearer.
No.
A massive throat clearer. I mean, we all do it. Like, you realize you do, but she does that all the time. And it drives him crazy.
Yeah. Dry cough.
Yeah.
A consistent dry cough.
But she does, clearing the throat, like. Aren't you always wondering, like, what are you still clear? I get it. Like, I can catch myself doing it sometimes, but I'm like, what?
Like, doing it for a purpose is one thing. Doing it because you have a compulsion is another thing.
Oh, my God, I love it. Let's run right into this. I'm here with Megan, and this is awesome. And you're going to get a proper introduction earlier, which I've probably already done for those who are listening. But I love that we're rolling into this because we've now covered lots of
really
television. And, like, really important things.
Really important things.
We've covered TV, reality TV. We've covered the fact that we both have issues with sound.
Life irritants,
Yes. And so, but what I love about this is, you know, something I feel like you're known for is kind of just being very real. You don't fly in the clouds of meditation. It's like you kind of bring meditation down to the public, let's say. And you get that. It's like you come in and you can have just a regular conversation with you right away where you don't feel like it has to be chakra based or what's the energy happening. And by the way, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
But sometimes you feel like some people can't not have a conversation unless that's motivating every thought.
Yeah. Well, and there's something beautiful about, at some level, embodying all of this enough so that you can move throughout your life as this version of yourself without constantly talking about this version of yourself.
Oh, my God. That's such a great way to put it. Because I say that all the time, too. I'm like, no. Like, because then I'll sometimes make a joke about it. And someone's like, oh, no, you don't understand. I'm like, no, I get it. Like, I fully understand it. I just feel like you can still say it this way.
Yeah.
And then I get mad at myself because I'm like, you know, anyone can say it whatever way they want to say it. Which is really,
I mean, ours is better, but say it. No, just kidding.
Oh my God, I love it. But it is funny because it is a whole, you know, in some ways I think it has scared some people from, you know, meditating and that's obviously shifting, but there was a period where I feel like that is the reason why people weren't actually starting to meditate because they felt like that meant they had to become this hippy dippy woo woo, like crystal chakra clearing, sage smelling, tea drinking person, which, by the way, I like most of those things I listed. So none of those are insults for me, but for some people it's not who they are at all.
Yeah. I think it still baffles me how intimidating it is, only because I'm immersed in this and this is all I think about and talk about and write about. And
so
I'm so far from what I was before I got into all of this, but it's still such an intimidating thing for people. And I think more than anything, yes, the sort of spiritual accessories can feel a little bit woo-woo and weird and like, why are you lighting that twig and what are you chanting? But I think beyond that, the underlying spark of that insecurity is just people being afraid of who they are beyond what they know.
Yeah, I think because a question I get a lot, which I'll pose to you to see how you answer it, or you can use your example of you, is people say like, well, doesn't it change your personality?
Yeah.
I like who I am. I don't want it to change.
Right.
So how do you feel like, you know, you were in the music industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much do you feel like, what parts of you do you feel like are different? What isn't different? Like who are you then? Who are you now?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely changed. You know, I used to be very, I used to be very New York. I used to be very self-deprecating and cynical and jaded in a very charming package.
I know.
But there was a sarcasm that masked a lot of anger or resentment or fear or discomfort and the uncertainty in areas of my life. And now that sarcasm is very much still there. A friend of mine was giving a talk somewhere and he goes, "You're so funny. Like, can you give me a few like jokes to say?" I was like, "Well, sure, I guess." And I sent him some kind of ideas and he was like, "Those are so good." He goes, "I could never say those though. Those are so sarcastic." And in my mind, I'm thinking, what are you talking about? Like, that's like G-rated.
That's
like,
hilarious.
Right? So I still definitely have sarcasm. You know, the wit, the sarcasm, but it's not in a self-deprecating way that's hiding a lack of self-worth or self-love. It's not covering up anger or resentment. It's not, right? So it comes out in a positive way.
Right.
You know, if there is such a thing. So I think that it's allowed me to sort of buffer away the parts of me that were inauthentic, that we're covering up something that wasn't real and wasn't actually who I am and wasn't actually an expression of my essence.
Right.
And it allowed those parts that maybe didn't get as much stage time, like compassion and self-love and self-worth and trust and surrender and all of these other things that I try to sit in most of the time to have more time in my life.
How do you feel like it shifted as you kind of came more into yourself that way? How did it shift your outside life as well? Like, obviously there was the job, which you can talk about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So talk about that. And then I want to talk about it on the personal side too.
Yeah.
But start with the...
I mean, professionally. And yeah. And I was fortunate that when I started meditating, I was 24. So it's not like I was, you know, bawling out at ICM, you know, making millions of dollars. And it's not like I had built up a career that was tempting to stay in.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's hard when you have, and especially as your sense of self gets wrapped up in different roles that we play. So I was very fortunate that I sort of had this sucker punch from the universe at an early age, because it was easy to say, wow, this doesn't feel in alignment. But what was the catalyst for that was not just I want to teach meditation, because that wasn't it at all. It just became really hard for me to stay in that world with this whole other perspective that I now had.
See, that's interesting.
And everything, you know, everything.
So it wasn't that you couldn't be in the world.
No,
it was like you were just struggling because you saw it so differently.
I saw it so differently. And, you know, and at a certain point, not, you know, irrationally, things have to be really important, right? Like ticket counts for Beyonce are very important. And I just had come from a week of learning about all of these other things that are important. And I just wanted to dive into that. So it was just like my ability to
care,
give all of myself and care as much as you need to care to enjoy that world. And no shade, you know, I still enjoy dipping into that world with friends and with, you know, people that I still have in those environments. I just like to be able to dip out when I am done.
That's such an interesting way to say it, because I get asked a lot too of like, well, don't you miss it? Don't you miss it from the TV days? And I'm like, I never missed it, because it was never, I never felt like it was this huge momentous thing of like, I no longer want to do you.
Right.
It was like a shift of like, no, I just need to do this right now. And like you said, there was no shade about it at all.
Yeah.
Like I still, I mean, all you and I did was talk about TV for like 20 minutes when you came in. Like I still love it.
Right.
So that's such an interesting way to say it, where it's like, I didn't have the same care at that time. And I always say, like, doesn't mean maybe one day I'll wake up and have that care and want to go do something in it. But so it was never this big shift, because it was just naturally where you have to start looking.
Yeah, and you still love TV, and I still love music and love talking about music and hearing about the business of music.
Yeah, me too. I still love hearing. I still ask the craziest questions about the business, because it's changing so much. I'm always like, tell
it's
me, how are you making the deals now?
Right. You just don't have the fuel or the interest in putting that, you know, as like the major thing in your life that you're funneling energy into. And, oh, by the way, I think it's, you know, there are transferable skills that, you know, you and I still get to use.
1,000%.
It's not like we went from being in the entertainment industry to living on top of a mountain.
Right.
Lighting sage.
No, I'd be screwed if I had to live by myself on top of a mountain.
Right. So
I watch those Survivor shows. I'm like, I need to go learn some skills. I don't have any of them. Don't give me like two things to make fire. It's just not happening.
But there are all these parts of who I was in music that I still get to be in.
Yeah.
It's just talking about meditation or writing about, you know, or doing something in this world instead.
Yeah, it's true, because people are like, do you feel creative? I'm like, I still get to be super creative. Mm-hmm. It's just in a different way. Like, it's so true. So how do you feel like it also affected, like, your personal world?
Yeah.
As far as, like, did you feel like when you were shifting as far as, you know, owning different parts of you, friends change? Like, how does, you know, I think that's a lot of fear for people, too, yeah. is... especially once they start doing it, it's like they might get into it, but when they actually start feeling this shift of, because mm-hmm. there is a way period sometimes for people where you don't know where you belong.
Yeah.
So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think, so I always say to people, you don't have to quit your job. You don't have to leave your life. You know, I definitely did that. And I left LA for a few years and went down to San Diego and worked for Deepak Chopra full time and immersed in my own healing and becoming a teacher and all of that. And then came back to LA, which was really interesting.
That must be super interesting.
Because I left music and almost immediately left LA and then spent 3 years in this whole other environment and then came back
culture.
To LA. Yeah. So again, it's not unlike the job thing where you just naturally start leaning towards other things. And the things in your life, the people in your life, the food in your life, the practices in your life, the behaviors, anything that isn't in alignment with that just doesn't stick as easily.
Right.
And so I've had a lot of friends that I used to work with at ICM that I was an assistant with that are still incredibly dear, close friends of mine. And we have this connection at a deep level and talk about meditation and spirituality and all of this. And then I have some people that... have, you know, we were really close for a little while and now we, you know, like each other's photos on Instagram, you know, and that's fine too. I don't think every relationship needs to be a forever thing. And I feel so happy with the version of myself that exists right now that I wouldn't trade that.
Is that kind of what you would say to people who are slowly getting into that like territory? Because it's interesting. You had a break, like you left and then came back. So yeah. It's almost like you could restart.
Yeah.
But for some people who are like stuck in it mm-hmm. and not having a chance to like leave, like, so it's, you start to kind of feel it and it's slow. I mean, yeah. It's not immediate. It's slow. It's like, you don't want to go to that party or right. You don't want to go to, why am I avoiding that person? I don't want to go to dinner with them. I'm not sure why, because mm-hmm. I actually really like them. Like, I feel like, but you do start to see shifts, and I get why people get a little nervous about that, because it feels like you have to shed a layer of skin.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not, I always try and answer people, it's not that you don't keep your personality, like right. You're still you.
Yeah.
You're the better
you're
version
just
of
lighter
you
and lighter freer and less
right.
afraid and
and I guess it's like reminding people, like, you will be supported in that. So even though it might feel like it's going to be look totally different when you're in it, you're going to have all the foundation you need
yeah.
to keep you up.
And those other things that you're afraid of letting go of won't feel good to hold on to.
Right.
Whether it's
that's a great
having
way to say
super,
it.
You know, gossipy conversations. You know, I used to have a lot of friendships that were not maliciously, but were very much in that vein of let's just sit around and talk about what's happening and who's happening and what they're doing, you know, and I that didn't feel good. So I stopped doing that. And guess what? Those people that wanted to do that stopped wanting to hang out with me so much because I wasn't
so true.
Indulging in that conversation or the relationships that I had that didn't have great boundaries. Once I started putting boundaries, they didn't really come around that much anymore because I wasn't playing along. So it's hard to hold on to things that don't feel good
yeah.
once you're aware of what does feel good.
So you were very lucky at a pretty young age. For 20, most people, their 20s are very tumultuous.
Yeah, I just did all of my work in terms of getting myself messed up just very quickly.
Like in a tight part of your 20s, you mean
yeah,
like early 20s,
yeah.
you just went for it?
Yeah, I just like everything started to fall apart.
What was falling apart for you?
My body, you know, more than anything else.
So was that out of the blue? Talk about that a little bit.
I mean, if you look back, no, it's not out of the blue. But
right.
in my ignorance, yes,
felt it.
I'm like, oh, why do I have chronic hives? Why do I have to get my gallbladder taken out from stress at 22? That's kind of strange.
I mean, that is crazy.
Yeah, like losing non-vital organs is not great. It's not a sign that like you're thriving. And it took my physical body starting to break down in a way that was unavoidable for me to look at my life and look at what was causing stress. And yes, the entertainment industry is stressful. That's a given. But my dad was also an alcoholic and, you know, incredibly sick from that. And facing that reality caused me to look back at all of the things growing up until that point that I hadn't actually dealt with.
You were close to him, right?
Yeah, I was so close to my dad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I very much was...
And did you always did you know he was an alcoholic? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, how
much
of...
I knew he was an alcoholic when I was in, like, elementary school.
You figured it out.
Yeah. I'm an only child, so it's kind of tough to, like, hide.
And your parents were married, right?
My parents were married.
So it was, like, the three of you.
Yeah, it was the three of us. Mm-hmm.
And he...
A little dysfunctional, loving family unit.
I mean, at least there was the loving part.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was an alcoholic. You became aware. Did you ever talk about it?
Yeah. And it was frustrating, and I had a lot of feelings that I just didn't know what to do with, especially in, like, high school and college. And at a certain point, those started to bubble up and become something that was unavoidable. I think I'm a very big believer that if you don't digest your stress, digest emotional toxicity, that it has to go somewhere. Like, the pain has to be expressed in some way, shape, or form. And I was very much the, like, I'm fine. It's fine. And it was not fine. And so it took having something physically be literally not fine for me to really start to look at all of the
reasons,
all of the things.
Were you a drinker, like, in high school? Like, were you a teen, 20s drinker? Or did you away?
I was never, I mean, I wasn't, like, the girl that was not drinking, but I didn't ever really worry about being an alcoholic. I always worried more about marrying an alcoholic.
Interesting.
Which I tried to do a few times. Luckily, none of those relationships ever stuck.
Also interesting, the patterns are strong.
There's so many, like, generations of that in my, you know, in my family.
But it's interesting you never worried about genetically. Do you have opinions on that? Genetically, alcoholism and addiction?
Yeah, I think it's a thing. I for sure think it's a thing. And I'm conscious of that. I mean, I don't drink a lot, but I'm conscious of that. And there's definitely shame that comes with, you know, drinking, you know.
For you?
For me, if I drink, you know, and again, this hasn't happened in a while, but if I drank too much, if I, like, accidentally, like, drank too much, I would feel so much shame about that.
And, like, where would it come from? Because you felt like you gave him a hard time, or you felt like you were becoming him? No, like, what was the shame?
I mean, there's layers to shame.
Give me a
layer.
There's
layers to all the shame. Yeah, it was not feeling in control. It was not being... aware of what I was doing and why I was doing it and feeling embarrassed about doing it, you know. Yeah. There's a lot of layers to being a child of an alcoholic.
Yeah, I'm sure. But you said there was a loving... How did his alcoholism
my
manifest
dad was like
in
my,
like...
My, you know, my dad... My mom was the breadwinner in my family. And so when I was born, my dad quit his job.
And stayed home. And so he stayed home with you.
In, like, the 80s, mid-80s.
That's amazing.
Like, old school, like, not the common...
He must have had great stories.
He was incredible. And he never, you know, he never drank when he was with me. I was never in danger. I was very fortunate that I had a very, you know, my dad loved me more than anything. But also was an alcoholic for most of my life.
Is your mom still with you?
My mom is with me. She lives in LA, which is really nice for me.
When he passed, how did she transform when he passed?
She started doing a lot of work. She started meditating. She started doing a lot of work while he was alive. So it was really just a continuation of that once he passed. But, you know, my dad passing, my dad getting sick enough that I knew that he was going to die from his alcoholism is the greatest catalyst that I've ever had in my life. It's the defining factor that caused me to get on this path, that caused me to find my purpose. I mean, I have nothing but just unconditional gratitude for that relationship and for the love that I felt. And it's the biggest lesson of everything. It's the biggest lesson for forgiveness that I've ever had. You know, being able to do this work while he was alive and tell him that I forgive him and mean it and love him unconditionally for a little while, and not if he didn't drink and not if he A, B, and C, and to just see him for who he was and love him for who he was is the greatest gift that I gave him and the greatest gift that I've ever been given.
I mean, it's
like the heart opening that comes with that.
Well, I'm like, no, but it's amazing. And it is the thing that I think is hardest for most people. Mm-hmm. And you had it in such an extreme way. It was a parent. Mm-hmm. So it's like right there. And it was alcohol. I mean, it was big. And so many people can't even do that in the small versions.
Right.
I mean, like, you look at all these crappy, annoying things that go on in relationships, and it's just simply because of that there. No one's able to just unconditionally
accept.
Accept.
It's a lot of
love. And then forgive. Yeah. Like, we talk a lot about cheating in here too. Mm-hmm. And I'm always the first person to be like, cheating is not the end of a relationship. Mm-hmm. Like, where it becomes the end is because people can't forgive and then they can't move on. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that's never the reason. Like, that's never, I'm not mm-hmm. condoning it by any means, yeah. but like, that's not the end. The end is there's other shit going on, and that can either allow you to go so much deeper and into a much more beautiful state. Yeah. But you have to be willing. It is another ultimate lesson of forgiveness and loving unconditionally. Yeah. And it's hard.
Yeah.
But it's...
And not taking it so personally.
Well, you talk about that, and, you know, she wrote this amazing book, which we'll chat a lot about, Don't Hate, Meditate, where you give, you know, I like how you talk about it through kind of five mm-hmm. filters. And, you know, I circled a bunch of times, like victimhood, because I do think it always goes back to that, whichever filter you're talking about in some ways, you can almost bring it back to like, do you want to be a victim or do you not want to be a victim?
Yeah.
And it's like what we're talking about here, like...
Is the world happening to you?
You said that and I loved it. I loved when you said that, where you basically said, I finally realized this was just happening and it wasn't happening to me, about your dad dying and everything. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, imagine if we all had that mm-hmm. capacity to realize everything that's moving in front of us, whether we perceive it as good or bad, mm-hmm. it's just happening. It's not always about mm-hmm. this angle of how it's happening.
And we perceive it and we define it as good or bad.
Well, that's huge.
And we rarely give ourselves the grace to be able to rest in it as it is, before we decide that this is what I like and this is what I don't like and this is good and this is bad.
And so much, do you think so much of that too is often on what we feel like we're supposed to think?
Yeah.
Like perception, you know, like whether it be about your dad, whether it be about cheating, whether it be, it's like, well, cause I think about that with cheating. I don't know why I keep, you know what, it came up in our last podcast, so I think it's on my mind now. But the thing with cheating too, I'm like, so many people won't forgive because they feel like it's going to make them look weak.
Right.
Or people are going to think they're being walked over or that they're just, you know, being taken advantage, whatever it is, whatever all the outside perceptions of the person who got cheated on.
Yeah.
So that person almost won't even start to try because they're not supposed to think that way.
Yeah. We let other people's narratives play a very big role in our own a lot of the time.
And societal narratives.
Yeah.
But it's so sad.
And it's wildly unhelpful most of the time. Because generally speaking, the other narratives that we are inviting in, whether it's intentionally or not, are not the ones that are going to empower us and lift us up and give us courage and strength and vulnerability.
No, those don't seem to be the ones that
come through,
right?
It's like the ones that are like, you're a piece of shit, you're doing terrible, who are, you know, we don't leverage the, our mind is capable of doing a lot of irrational things, and we don't leverage our mind and the power of our mind to do the irrational positive things.
So true. I mean, and that's what I love that you say. You kind of, you give all these tips and there's awesome quizzes in there. I mean, it's really a really good hands-on book, especially for someone who, if you're new to meditation, I strongly recommend it. Even if you've been meditating a while, I would read it because it gives you a lot of good insight to what you're doing and also just understanding yourself better, especially with those quizzes. You really get a sense of like, oh shit, I really got to work this area that I wasn't thinking.
Yeah, the quizzes are fun. I had a lot of people take them too and say, wow, I thought I was going to, you know, be really great at A, B, and C. And it turns out I actually really need to work on trust. And I would never have
I know, it surprised me, which, one didn't surprise me at all, but it was, but yeah, it surprised me areas where I was actually like really okay. I was like, oh, who knew? That actually surprised me more. But I do strongly recommend it, but I do feel like so much of it is also, you talk about going back to just the meditation period, because what you were just saying is like, we don't empower our minds to take us through the irrational in the way that's actually going to help
us. Right. If you're going to do that, at least do it in a good way. If you're going to leave this moment and make up something in your mind and then react to that something, at least have it be the good thing.
It's so true. What do you feel like when you started learning? Cause you know, talk a lot about detaching from your thoughts.
Yeah.
And you know, we talk about this a lot on this podcast of the myth of you're not going to have thoughts when you meditate. I mean, it's just, I used to say when I worked the front desk here, every time someone would walk in, I'm like, you are going to be thinking. And if you've never meditated, your mind's going to wander a gazillion times.
Yeah.
That's still meditating. You're okay. Yeah. So I love how you talk about that. But, you know, when you do get better at like learning to detach and like you said, be able to kind of take the moment to see things clearly and not have to kind of put your point of view on every single thing.
You just don't get involved as quickly.
What do you feel like for you, you noticed the most when that started happening for you?
My road rage.
Really?
Yeah, I used to have terrible road rage because I learned how to drive correctly.
She's from New Jersey, by the way.
I live
so
in
I
Los
agree
Angeles.
With you. But do you know how many people think we drive like shit from New Jersey?
We just are conscious and aggressive, but in a very safe way.
Agreed. Thank
That's
you. You just said it perfectly.
We're very aggressive drivers. I'm not saying that we're not aggressive,
but we're aware
of everything that's happening.
Yes.
And if like your
a woman
blinker is
heart.
On, like I know that that's happening, so I know I need to either like speed up or slow. We're just very aware, so we can be aggressive safely.
Oh my God! So just interjecting a dumb story, but my husband will never lets me drive, which is fine because I don't love driving, so it's like a perfect combination. But when we were on the East Coast this summer, we had two different cars, and for I don't remember what we were doing. We were like returning a rental or something, whatever. And so I was with my daughter in the car in front, and he was behind. And I was actually really proud because it showed how well I knew my way around, which I hadn't for years. Yeah. And it was funny. We got out. He's like, I have to say, you had some really good moves up there. I'm like, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, there was that weird truck that was in the middle and you knew exactly when to wait, but you also knew when to pull ahead. And with the bikers, you knew not to do it. And I looked at him. I'm like, yeah, I'm a good driver.
Drive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was like, I'm a good driver. You've never given me credit, but like, I'm a good driver.
That's true. But when you try to drive like that out here, it's just incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, that's true.
Because the rules of the road don't apply here in Los Angeles. So I used to have really bad road rage. Not like I'm going to get out of the car and like take a bat and, you know.
Yeah, which you have to qualify
to, like,
here because that
you.
Does happen.
Yeah. So not physically rage.
Screaming.
Like behavior.
Screaming.
Just very irritated. Yes.
Cursing?
And it would like... Not at people, but yeah, like it would take over my whole body, and it would be like the tight grip on the steering wheel, and be like, "What are you doing? Like,
yeah.
What the fuck?" Right. So yes, that type of behavior. And I noticed once I started meditating, not like far into my practice, you know, maybe like maybe a month or so.
So funny.
I noticed that I would still have just like the batshit crazy road rage thought, but there would be this space, and I would think to myself, "Wow, you sound like an insane person. You should really let that thought go." And 90% of the time, even to this day, 92% of the time, maybe at this point, it doesn't become anything more than, in my mind, that thought. And that's what meditation gives you. It gives you the grace time to decide how you want to be and who you want to be.
Oh, I love that.
And for most people, that's what you need. Most people, given a little bit of grace time, aren't going to choose to be the worst version of themselves.
Right. It's really dark when they do. And it happens.
Right. And then there, you know, we have documentaries for that. So so if you can give yourself like
so
that
funny.
Moment, you know, to notice your thought and say, wow, look at that thought I'm having. That's interesting.
And I mean, and that goes back to a little bit of like the victim and the self. It's like, remember that it is just a thought.
Yeah. You don't have to believe every thought you have. You don't have to invite every thought in to become the building block of your reality.
Now, have you noticed... Like, okay, so I love this idea. It's what we talk about all the time of like you have this grace period so you can actually witness the thoughts and you realize they don't define you.
Yep.
But have you noticed now, having meditated for many, many years, mm-hmm. have you noticed that the quality of thoughts are changing?
Yeah. That changes too. Don't worry.
So that
there's hope for all of us.
Yeah, because I like to tell people that too. It's like you kind of weirdly reprogram yourself to actually download different thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I reconditioned my set point for how I see the world. I went from having, you know, lenses of cynicism and negativity, really, and very much, you know, the New Yorker, the very charming, like, of course this is happening to me. Why wouldn't this happen to me? And
right.
I can still become Larry David very quickly. But most of the time, that's not the case because I have, like, buffered those neural pathways out of my brain so that, not out completely, but
right.
so that they are not the primary road that my attention takes. So
right.
when there's a thing that happens, my automatic go-to is no longer, why is this happening to me? What's wrong with this situation? Why is this terrible? Now it's like presence and what's not wrong about this? And where's the gem? Where's the pearl? Like,
I mean, perspective, I think, is huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's so underestimated how quick, you know, I talk about this with my daughter a lot and it's not quite getting through yet, but I keep being, there's like a really great book about like a choose your own adventure book. She's four.
Yeah, I loved those books.
And me too, which is why I bought
Are
it.
Are you reading her like the old school version?
No,
or
I wish
ones?
I found one for her age and I was like, oh great. And turns out there's actually a message in it, which is even better, which is all about the reason this is a choose your own adventure is you get to see how your choices totally affect your
that's
day.
Cool.
So I love it. So I use that with her a lot now. I'm like, don't forget the power of choice. And I mean, she's such a wise ass because I can be like, when she's like super impatient and wants her food, I'm like, remember, you can choose to be frustrated or you can choose to be okay. And she's like, I'm going to choose to be frustrated. It's like, she just says, I'm like, all right, that's your choice.
It's like, your choice.
It's your choice. But as long as you understand that you get to choose and change the
that
feeling.
That what you favor will... It has an impact on you.
Yeah. Like you can choose it and then be frustrated or choose that. Not be frustrated, but if you want to be frustrated, do it. Just your choice.
Yeah.
But I do find it so many people, and she's four.
It's great. She sounds like me. This is a girl after my own heart.
I mean, she's a wise ass. So, but I know, but like now let's think 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s.
Right.
So many don't realize the power of choice. Mm-hmm. And look, and there's more. You say it in here too. It's not even just about intellectualizing it. There's like, you have to do the work behind it. So you should talk a little bit about that too. But it does, I do think, start with, like you said, what's the gem? Where's the, like, to be able to know that there's...
Yeah, being conscious that there are, right, that there are options.
Yeah.
Like choiceless options, you know? And unfortunately, once you get past 7 or 8 years old, those initial neural pathways have been formed.
I know you said that. You said that was Deepak says that, right?
Yeah, and that's the initial. I mean, there's conditioning after that, but that's like the initial moment that really starts to be ingrained. And so unless you're doing something, unless you have a mom that meditates, you know, or a dad that meditates, or someone in your life that's continuing to remind you of these things,
right?
It becomes really easy to... You know, which is what most people do, think the same things over and over and over,
right.
Want the same things over and over and over and over, make the same choices based on those desires over and over and over and over and over. That's what most adults do.
I know. And then we're just teaching our kids that. And then they do it. I mean, it's like we're not breaking the cycle.
Right. Well, you are now.
It's all up to us. We're all breaking the cycle by meditating. I love it. Talk about a little bit how I was just saying, you have to, like the
intellectual.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think... I think there's a lot of superficiality around personal growth right now, especially because we want things in like 30 seconds and we're scrolling through content and we're not very much interested as a general society in going deep, right?
Right.
And we want things quickly and there's such a difference between intellectually understanding a concept and actually embodying the qualities needed to like implement that concept.
1,000%.
Which is why you can read a great quote or a great whatever and think, or double tap and think, wow, yeah, that's great. I should do that more. And then it never happens because you aren't that. And for me, meditation is really that bridge between
helping you get there.
Intellectually, you know, the things that you see that stimulate your mind in that way should be like the reminder, right? So when I'm having a bad day and I'm looking at whatever I'm looking at and I see that great quote, then I'm like, oh, that's right. And that's going to just reinforce something that's already planted within me. That thing that is outside of me is not the source.
Well, we get that all the time here too. People are like, wait, I took a class, why aren't I better? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like the quick fix.
Right. The external is the reminder, is the reinforcement. You have to plant that seed within yourself and continue to nourish that and then use all of the external as the adjunct support.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that too with like social media these days and, you know, it's a touchy subject because I get why people do it, but you know, you were saying it's like, it's great for it to be inspirational left and right, but how do you go deeper? And also like in a world of, you know, trying to get out of the duality when everything on Instagram is like or dislike. I mean, not that you can dislike something, but you're basically disliking it when you're not
liking it.
And stuff like that. How it's like and it's tricky because so many of us are using that as a medium.
Yeah.
So it's
so funny when they changed the algorithm recently on Instagram. Far fewer people see your posts unless you've already engaged with them and people just started to lose it. There's also been talk about them removing the number for how many likes you have.
Oh.
And people are just...
Oh, well, people who's dependent on it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's so interesting how we have completely leaned into the external outlets to be...
Which is so sad because, and by the way, and like our industry is not exempt from that. I mean, if anything, it's become a problem, I think, within that too, because then it becomes a question. I'd be curious to know your opinions too of like intention versus action and what are you doing and why? Mm-hmm. And it's tricky because, look, we like for this, as Sen, it's like we run a business. We have to run a business, but like we've never been a place that like it's like we don't hire people just be, if they have big Instagram accounts or not. Because it's like some people are amazing healers or amazing teachers that have no following because their brains do not work that way. But it's like, but then yet, of course, it's going to be harder to get people to know who that teacher is. Mm-hmm. So there's like a double-edged sword to all of
it. And like the authenticity.
Well, that's the trick. And like we talk about, I get asked a lot, like when I'm on panels, like marketing panels and stuff about like influencers and stuff. And I always say like, look, we have a very different industry. I'm not selling bags. Mm-hmm. I get where influencers are huge. Mm-hmm. We don't do it here. If it naturally happens, great. But we don't do it here because the whole thing I'm trying to teach or have like people teach is authenticity. Yeah. So we can't not be authentic in our sale. Mm-hmm. So it is really interesting, but how do you feel? I'm sure you see, whether it be friends or coworkers, that, you know, you can feel it sometimes. You can feel what's happening on there, that it's just going for the numbers or the likes or, you know, the followers, and it starts to lose a little authenticity.
And it is this sort of, as you're saying, like cyclical thing. Because, of course, if you're you know, creating a big event, of course you want people that are known so that people will come to see that event and then reap the benefits of this incredible event that you've curated with intention and, you know, and that is absolutely benevolent. And at the same time, is the depth of that teaching going to be the same as if you, it's a very sort of double-edged sword. And there is a lot of that in wellness. There are a lot of, especially with meditation, you know, meditation's not the most like quantifiably driven like credential. And there are a lot of people that call themselves meditation teachers that, you know, learned how to breathe on YouTube and now they teach meditation. And so I think it's just, I always believe that, you know, the cream rises to the top, that the people that
I do too.
That have a depth of practice in their own life, that walk the walk as well as teaching and talking the talk, I do believe that those are the people that will have legs beyond just like that great photo and that great like and that great sponsorship. And I do think that people, when you're sitting in a room with someone that embodies the teachings that they're teaching, that's a different experience.
And you can feel it.
And you as the meditator, you as the participant, as the attendee, whatever it is, you have a different experience. Because being able to hold space in a meditation for a room full of people is different than just sitting in front of people with your eyes closed.
It's so true. You know? And it's funny because people are always like, what is this thing that means hold space? Like, what is that? But I think that's a great way to say it, where you're setting up, it's almost like you're creating the platform for people to meditate on in that exact space that you're in versus just being with them in a room.
Yeah, you're like holding this container.
Yeah.
And you do that with your depth and people can feel that. You know, people can go deeper into that.
For sure. You talk about in your book a little bit, which I think fits in with what we're talking about the difference of like motivation not being about acquiring something. Mm. So do you want to like expound on that? Because I do feel like it fits in a little bit with what we're talking about now.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of again, letting the external be a reflection of the internal. So for me, it's much more about who do I want to be and how do I want to be and those qualities and how do I align my external world to be a reflection of that rather than taking the external elements and having them imprint. Because, you know, anything, spoiler alert, anything outside of yourself is impermanent.
Right.
Right? Is threatenable, is able to be taken away at a moment's notice. And most people rest their worth and who they are and their sense of self on all of those impermanent things, which is why it feels so fucking scary to be alive. Because
it's changing.
Every part of you is able to be threatened. There's so much constriction in our relationships and in our job and in what we have and our bank account, and because that's who we are.
Right. And it's a relationship can end tomorrow. Someone can pass away. Yeah. Someone can leave
Things
you.
Things happen all the time.
Your job goes away. Your bank account can go down. It can all of a sudden go up.
Yeah. It's so impermanent.
Yeah.
And if you can, and this is what you do every time you meditate, if you can start to plug into who you are and to yourself and use yourself as that source of power, and knowingness and wholeness, that part of you that you plug into is unable to be threatened. You know, your soul can't be fired. Your soul can't be cheated on. Your soul can't go broke. Your soul can't be relocated. Your soul doesn't have any health issues.
Right.
And it's not that any of those things outside of you don't matter, but if that's only what you're striving for, it's never going to feel great.
It's so interesting how, like, so few people actually are aware of their own soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and have a just connection. Never acquainted. Yeah. Right. You didn't get to know that part of you. Yeah.
Which is so sad. It's funny because my daughter literally was, she was like, what's a soul? Which we talk about. It's funny. And like you explain it and it is very esoteric. But like, like I'm glad she's asking because I'm like, at least you'll be aware something deeper exists.
We've also moved really far away from being connected to the things in our external world that innately remind us of our soul. So like nature and human connection. There's so much of how we navigate life now that takes us out of, you know, being in the trees and like hearing the wind rustling through the leaves and feeling something or looking people in the eye for longer than 0.2 seconds or, you know, and so there aren't as many things adding to that for us naturally.
How do you think people learn to look in the eye?
Well, I think at one point it was necessary to communicate.
Right.
And now I think it's when you have an annoying meditation teacher like me that makes you do eye gazing. I don't, you know, I think they learn how to look in the eye because you have to look in your phone when you record videos.
Yeah.
You know.
No, but it's interesting because it's like, yeah, you need to learn to look in people's eyes.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was young, I remember being taught a few very specific things. I remember being taught when I was very little, like 3 or 4, how to walk in New York. You know, you walk with like a sense of purpose. Exactly. Yes, exactly. That gesture. You walk with a sense of purpose. You don't look at anyone in the eye for too long. Right.
Right.
And you always keep going. So if you can cross the street one way.
So funny you say it.
You
one
walk
of my favorite
way.
Things to do in New York when I was younger was to actually make eye contact, but you keep going. So it's like these brief moments of like intense, like two people are literally and then you keep going. You don't turn back. You just keep going. Yeah.
And I remember learning how to hail a cab. And I remember, my little like 3-year-old Megan is out there. Yep. And I remember learning how to order food at a restaurant. And my parents would make me order food when it was so terrible to do that at like 4 years old.
And they would make my daughter do that.
Yeah. And they would make me look in the eye.
I make her do that.
And speak with like confidence and authority. Same thing with handshakes, probably because my mom was like a businesswoman. I learned how to shake hands. Like, do you want to? Yeah, it's a good
you and
handshake.
I have good. Oh, we're both strong.
You know, my mom was like, "Don't ever give anyone like your fingertips."
Oh, yeah.
There's like
nothing.
This thing.
Oh, worse.
So I think you. I think you're taught that. I think you're taught
and
that.
And I don't think it's bad to be taught that and reminded to do it. It's funny because we were just talking about this kind of on a different podcast too about remind. It's interesting. There's so. Oh my god.
But now, if I'm 35. Like I just really count because I'm too old. No. You know, people my age that are having kids, they're at restaurants and, you know, everyone has a phone, everyone has an iPad. No one, you know, so it's just, I mean, restaurants now have like iPads that you order on. So
I know.
There's just not as many natural opportunities to reinforce those things.
It's sad.
We have lifts. We don't even have to hail cabs.
I know. Well, when you were telling the cab story, I'm like, it's sad. I just hailed a cab randomly. I was in New York and I hailed one to go to the airport.
Yeah.
Or something. I hailed one to do something. Or just one day. But normally I was Ubering everywhere. Because even in New York, you can Uber now. Mm-hmm. But I do like to hail a cab. There's something very, like...
Satisfying.
Where you can... it's like, again, it's the contact. It's like you're making eye contact from so far away. Yeah. You don't even know you are, but you are. You're, like, looking into them. You've got the thing. I don't know. I love it.
Yeah. There's a recognition that you exist in someone.
For sure. Yeah. But I do think those are all really, like, your parents, those were, like, good things.
Yeah, they were good things.
And they were small, but good.
But, like, I remember them.
But they're also very, they make you strong and independent.
Mm-hmm.
And did you feel like you were always an independent kid and strong?
Yes, I was very independent. I was a very little, that's very dramatic. I lost my innocence very young. But I was a very, like, little.
In what way?
I was a very, like, little adult. And that is, I think, part.
Do you think also part of being an only child, or no?
Yeah. Because there's no one else to talk to. My parents were certainly not like making baby voices at me.
Right.
And when you're at a restaurant, there's no one to talk to except your parents. And they're certainly not skewing the whole conversation to be around this one kid.
It's so funny. My best friends have an only child that is one of the most amazing humans ever. And it's the same thing. Like we forget how old she is because she hangs out. Like whenever she comes out to visit, I'll do a dinner with all my girlfriends and then the daughter comes with. And it's like, we always forget how old she is because she's just awesome. I'm sure she might be listening to this.
She probably sits there quietly and like does
or engages in an amazing way. Yeah. Like either, exactly, sits there quietly, doesn't expect everyone to cater to her. Right. Or when she engages, engages in a highly intelligent, easy to talk to way where you don't feel like it's like, oh, time to talk to the kid. It never feels like that. Yeah. She is like, she's awesome.
I think as an only child, you're just in an adult world a lot of the time.
Yeah. Interesting. I love that we got off on that topic. talk about in... Well, I want to go. You said one thing. You were just talking about the breathing on YouTube and stuff like that. And you also talk about in your book a little bit how breathing and meditating are two very different things. Because, again, there's like myths you dispel, which I love. Yeah. And by the way, her book is all told in this voice, which I also love. It's very you. It's very like wise-assy in a good way and just, you know, keeping it real, which you say a bunch. You're like, I'm not going to be 100% with you.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the differences so people know.
Yeah. You know, I think you can use your breath, absolutely, as a tool to meditate, and you can rest your attention on your breath and on the physical sensation of your breath, on the fact that you're breathing, on the pace with which you're breathing. You can manipulate your breath. All of those things are putting your attention on this meaningless thing, which is your breath, which is what gives your mind a break, because you're giving your mind something to do. Because as you said so beautifully, meditation is not about stopping your thoughts.
Right.
Right. So you give your mind this thing to focus on. And when you drift away, you come back to it, right? That is not the same as just sit there and breathe for 5 minutes.
Right.
Right. There's an awareness.
There's an action involved with the breathing.
Yeah. There's an awareness of it and a purposeful attention on it. So,
I like that.
Yeah.
It is true because it's, you know, it's that same thing when people are like, you know, I knit, that's my meditation, or I run. And I'm like, those
meditative,
are
totally,
totally meditative, totally, but it's meditative, not meditation.
But that's not meditation.
It's a good break, which everyone needs.
Yeah.
But it's funny. I try and explain that too. I'm like, no, it's great. And you should do that, especially for people that are like adrenal crazy. I'm like, anything you
coloring,
can do.
Coloring, the mindful coloring, all of that is very meditative. Cooking, because you're focused on something. But the thing that's different is that when you meditate, you are doing something meaningless, focusing on something meaningless. Generally, there are lots of different kinds of meditation, but generally you're focusing on something that doesn't mean anything to your mind, whether it's, I use a Sanskrit mantra in the book, and that's what I teach in classes and stuff.
But so hum.
Whether it's a meaningless mantra that you're saying to your mind, meaningless, or the breath, you're noticing when you drift away and you're bringing yourself back. And every time you do that, it's like doing a mental rep.
Right. That's how I always describe
it. And building that muscle of awareness. You're not actively doing that when you're knitting. Unless you are, in which case, maybe that's a little bit more meditation-y. But you're still at a pretty high active level of mental activity.
Also, it's hard because I have so many friends that are still in the entertainment industry and are crazy. I mean... are insane, obviously. I mean, they're running ragged. I know their adrenals are shot. I'm like, my adrenals are still shot, and I meditate all the time. It's like I know where they're at. And then, you know, they're like, I got to go work out. And I'm like, I'm not telling you that you shouldn't be physical, because we all need it and you need the thing. I'm just saying that's just making your adrenals go even crazier, because you're just amping up more. And I feel like that's where we haven't yet started talking about it that way in society, because, you know, people are always like, oh, you either have the gym membership or maybe you're the type of person who wants to meditate. But meditate usually comes after that. And again, I'm not saying don't be in good physical health. It's so important. But what I don't think people realize in physiology is like the part of your physical body that is going crazy through work and through stress, you're actually elevating when you're exercising, usually in those ways. I mean, if you're doing Tai Chi or something, that's totally different.
Totally. But like, that's a moving meditation. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it's like... and then they don't realize you're kind of perpetuating the problem, even though in those moments you're burning off a lot of energy that probably feels great.
Which feels great, which gives you enough relaxation to fall asleep, which is really what you're looking for.
Right.
If you're in that
position.
It's
like the non-medical quick fix.
Right. But you're not doing anything to become more aware of your mind, to recondition yourself, to, right, all of those deeper level benefits that come from meditation, all of the brain benefits that come from meditation, you know, you're not getting any of that.
And there's so many.
And you're not giving your body a chance to, as you said, to like rejuvenate and restore itself.
At all.
At all.
And it's funny because one of the things you said early when I said talk about your, you know, how you change, and you said, well, who doesn't want to feel lighter? And you use that word. And I think that's a perfect way to say it, because I try and explain that to people too. It's like, you know, when people are like, how are you? And I'm like, I'm great. And then it doesn't mean anything particularly great is actually happening, but it's that lightness of feeling that feels fucking great.
Lightness of being.
And that feels great.
I wake up most days like very content for no reason.
I mean, that's beautiful.
And it's not because I'm like bawling out. It's not because I'm in like the romantic relationship of my dreams. It's not because I'm a New York Times bestseller. It's not because, it's just because I'm at peace with who I am.
That's beautiful.
And I can't imagine anything greater than that.
No.
And it's only because I sit by myself, and or not by myself always, but because I sit quietly twice a day. I mean, what are we doing?
No, but it's true. It's worth the investment.
It's just, yeah, it's worth the
time.
So here's
my question for you, you teach, a mantra, mantra meditation. What are your thoughts on then Vedic meditation or TM? I mean, I have so many thoughts. I learned TM when I first started.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole thing between the Vedic and the TM and, well, I mean, that's a whole other story,
Basically
at the core, and I try and explain this to people, it is just a mantra-based meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts on the idea that sometimes, because I see it, people come in all wide-eyed, they're like, but I have to do this thing called Vedic meditation, or I have to do this thing called TM, which are inherently the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, I have to, and look, people need to do whatever is going to work for them, is what I always say. And it's like this polite version of just trying to dispel that this is a very special thing that is so unique that you have. I mean, look, I have strong opinions clearly about it, where I feel like it's part of the reason I opened up the Den is because I felt like there was so much of this like exclusivity
around. And like secrecy. There's a lot of secrecy.
And that really happened with a friend of mine once who was like, my friend won't teach it to me because she said blah, blah. And I'm like, oh my God, I'll teach. And this was before I was like, I'll teach you. And that's actually when I was like, that attitude's not okay.
Yeah.
Because it's ridiculous. So for someone who does teach a mantra-based meditation, what are your opinions?
So I learned how to meditate with Deepak Chopra, and that's who I became a teacher underneath. So I learned primordial sound meditation, which is just an offshoot of Vedic / TM, which is like Kleenex and tissues, just branded differently.
Yep.
Everything else is the same, to my knowledge. And I received a mantra, which was based on my birth information, which represents the sound that the earth was vibrating at when I was born. And that's the first thing that I ever meditated with. So I have a deep relationship with that mantra because of what it has unfolded within me.
Right. I say the same thing. I have a respect for
it. Yeah. And that mantra is meaningless. It's a vibration. In essence, it's a meaningful vibration because it's this vibration that I heard when I went from being nothing but, potential to being this being that has all these other layers to me, like a body and a mind. And that being said, that isn't necessary to meditate.
Right.
I love mantra meditation.
Me too.
For a lot of reasons, one of which probably the most prevalent is that it's a thought. So I can't meditate for an hour using my breath as a point of focus. I don't pay attention to the fact that I'm breathing most of the time. So to like sit down and be like, I'm going to focus on my breath now. That's really challenging for me and for my like New Yorker mind.
Mm-hmm.
Using a mantra, it's thinking something. It's more effortless than that. So I don't use that word, but essentially you're giving your mind a thought, which is what it wants. It just happens to be a thought that doesn't mean anything to your mind because it's Sanskrit.
Right.
And I wasn't raised speaking the language of Sanskrit. So that's why I love mantras. Mantras also essentially have been used for thousands of years. So the theory of it is that there's this potency to the vibration that you're using and there's a depth to that. But you don't need your own mantra to meditate.
No. That's what I was trying to explain to people. I teach Kundalini too. So like I'm all about the mantra and the chant. Yeah. I love it. It's like totally.
It's also silent. So that's the other thing. Sometimes people are like, they take my class, they're like, wait, I don't understand. Am I going to have to chant that? Or do I have to chant this now every day? And
you're like, no.
Just in your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, but it is interesting. Again, there's a culture and politics in every industry.
100%. Yeah.
And so it's been fascinating to watch.
And it's an industry. And there's money and
high money being exchanged.
High money. I always really appreciated that about Deepak's trading, that we were never encouraged. Like the price that we were encouraged to charge is like very, very reasonable.
Right.
Very much, very different from, you know, pay me $12,000 and I'll give you this mantra that will change your life, you know?
Yeah. It is interesting because there is, like you said, there's a secrecy about it. And I'm always like, no, it's a mantra yeah. and everyone has access
like,
to mantra.
Like, I'll tell you whatever you want to know. And the reason that, the reason that you're not supposed to share your mantra, because that's always a big question too,
yeah.
is like, I was told that you're not supposed to share it. And does that mean that we all have the same one? And it's only because the moment that you start sharing it, it has meaning.
Right.
The moment that you start using it outside of your meditation, the moment that you start allowing other people's opinions to get imprinted on it, it's no longer a meaningless thought, which is where it has the most value for you in your practice.
I love that. And I think it's so important for people to know.
Yeah.
With intention, because you talk about that's one of your, you know, the five things. When you talk about intention, how important... Talk about, I always get a little, and there's differing opinions on it. So I'm always curious to know people's thoughts about with intention. How specific are people supposed to be, in your opinion, when setting intentions?
So I think setting intentions and acknowledging desires and what you want are two different things.
Okay.
For me. For me, the intention is the moment to moment, the daily thing, the weekly thing, the monthly thing that you're going to align yourself with to stay on the path to where you want to go.
Right.
Right. It's the thing that drives you in your moments. The thing that sponsors how you're thinking, the thoughts you're believing, the story you're telling yourself, the words you're speaking, the actions you're taking. And then that leads you to, you know, hopefully the desired state or the desired destination, quote unquote. In all of my manifesting magic, of which there are some moments, the initial stages of like, what do I want for me are always, I always endeavor to have them be very, very broad and very, not unfocused, but detached. I really try to assume that I don't know best whenever possible. And any time that I have...
I agree with that.
Yeah, I don't know best. It's so great once you really like land in that.
Yeah, we'll keep going.
No
and
pressure.
Then...
Like, you don't know best. It's like, oh, great. Yeah. I'll let something else handle it then.
Right.
Right? So I think it's important to know, like, what you want, but really why you want it.
That's where I fall on it.
Yeah.
But then some people are like, no, you have to be super specific, time, color, yeah. this, that. And that always makes me nervous because I'm like... I don't know. I feel like so much of this, again, is about going to the soul and knowing that there's a bigger purpose that we might not always be clear mm-hmm. what direction that is.
Yeah.
And I like the why behind it. And I've said that because I've said that about motherhood before because like I've adopted and I try and walk people through it where I'm like, when you get stuck in that muck of like things aren't working
right. And
the way it's not working, you just
it's because it's not working the way you wanted it
yes.
to work.
And I'm like, and just remind yourself you can be a mother if you want to be.
Yeah.
And remember why you wanted to be a mom.
Right.
And then that's it. And then know it'll happen. Mm-hmm. It just might not look the way you thought it was supposed to. So that's where I always come from, which is if we get too locked in, but no, I want this specific job or I want this versus like what's behind that? Is it feeling a certain way? Yeah. Is it needing a certain
income? There's always
income?
A reason why is we want it, the thing we want.
Yeah, like, and I'm with you where I feel like try and channel into what that is. And then ask for help in getting that, whatever, but be open to however it's going
to
look.
Right. Be open to, because I don't know the greatest version of.
No, it could be much bigger than you possibly can dream.
It likely will be because, by the way, that thing will be in your future and hopefully you're not the same exact version of yourself as you were when you dreamed that up, right? So you have to give your dream like breath to grow with you.
Yeah.
To evolve with you.
And also... the ability to know that if you're not open to it, you very, very well may miss the package you're asking for in the first place, which I think happens all the time.
Right, because it's not the thing that we thought we wanted. And yes, like do the vision board, like put up what what it looks like to you and what it feels like and the color of it and but allow the essence of it to be what is like the guiding force.
Yeah, I like that.
Especially once you start to have like a practice and you feel comfortable like resting, because it's a lot of, we don't like uncertainty. So it's another lesson in how comfortable can you be in the discomfort of not knowing exactly what, when, where, why, who.
I know. It sucks not to know sometimes. It's funny. I actually don't, I kind of sometimes like the uncertainty of things because it reminds me of being a kid and how exciting everything was. So like I've had less problem with like change than a lot of people because for me, I used to love... I remember like pulling up to bus stops and like looking out and seeing all the different people at a bus stop and being like, what am I going to be at that age? I can be anything. I was like, yeah, the possibilities were endless, and they really were. Now look,
by the way, they still kind of are.
And they are. And it's true. As you get older, you feel it a little less because you might, I hate saying locked in because no one's ever locked in, but yes, you might not.
Well, you fit your possibilities into the constricted version of your life that you're in right that moment.
Yes, exactly. And there's more of a constriction than then when there's zero.
Right.
But exactly, I still feel like...
But all those things are still there.
Yeah, and there's always possibility. So I always kind of like the unknown a little bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sometimes, I mean, we've all been there, right? Like if you think you're supposed to break up with someone or not and you want to ask every psychic, like every answer, what's going to happen? Am I supposed to be with them? Like, it's funny. You just want all the answers.
I have a really great numerologist in LA. Shout out to Josh Siegel. He's the best.
I love it. We're getting all these great names.
The first time he ever met me, he didn't know anything about me. He didn't know that I used to work in music. He didn't know that I was working for Deepak at the time. And he just like nailed me and knew everything about me based on like my numbers. And he'll do his whole reading and then you can engage with him. So he doesn't let you interject at all in the first like download that he's having for you. And I'll never forget. He goes, you know, you probably, if you aren't already, you probably will start very much diving into like spirituality. You should definitely do that. But you definitely have the propensity to be like a little bit of a spiritual whore. So I want you to be careful of like how many readings you're getting and how many like books you're getting and how many decks you're pulling from and how many. And he was right. Because in that time in my life, I was very much like, do you know the answer? Like, are you my mother? You know,
it is.
Do you know the answer? Do you know what I'm supposed to be? Like, do you know who I am? Do you know?
And it's funny. And people don't realize like you ask all those questions and it's part of the reason you're insecure is because you're not actually going to the right place for the answer.
Which is inside you.
Exactly.
Yeah. And again, like we were saying before, those external things. Now when I go see him, it's very much like an affirmation of some things that I was maybe already sensing or like it's to help me just have another completely objective
point of view
on things. And it always leaves me feeling affirmed. It's never, oh my God, really?
Right.
This is going to be about this year, you know? And that's a really great feeling. Gives you confidence to lead it to you. Instead of, you know.
Well, yeah, it's just, it emboldens you to know that you actually have the answers.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, like, because what I love about this book and I love about how you speak, again, it is so grounded. What's your woo-woo side? Or do you not have a woo-woo side?
My woo-woo side. I mean.
Like, do you believe past lives?
Yeah. I believe in all that shit. Yeah. I believe in past lives. I think I'm super woo-woo. I think I just sound like someone you would want to get a drink with.
But that's a great package because for so many people, it's the only way to accept it.
Yeah. I really like, I like getting dressed up. I like, you know, I don't know. Like, so yeah, I think my woo-woo is who I am at this point. And it's authentic. And that's the other thing that we keep kind of circling back to. So the things that aren't authentic or that don't feel in integrity or whatever it might be with me, don't come into my life. So the things that are kind of out there fit. They feel on brand because they
No, it's so true though, because I feel like we spend so much energy, like you said, locking on to external factors or blaming other people or, you know, being the victim, all that. That it's like when you release all that energy, you have so much to play with. And then it's like you know who you are and you can literally pull in the things that just match, like you said, your brand.
Yeah. Yeah, the things that fit. And the things that don't fit don't stick.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I love it. She's very empowering, isn't she? It's so great. Do you have like a sign? I like to ask this question. Is there a sign for you that lets you know you're on the right path besides, what's his name? Josh Goldstein. Who's your numerologist?
Oh, Josh Siegel.
Goldstein. Another good Jew.
Another
boy.
Great Jew. Yeah. We will very much own that. You know, I don't know. I don't have like a specific, like when I have a few different things. I have a few different ways that I connect with my dad in very like potent ways. And
like
so
what?
That always feels, I always, music is like a big one. You know, I heard a song like the moment he was dying and I like felt him. I was there with him, but I had like, he waited until my mom and I like left the room and I was in the car and like the minute that, anyway, that, so he and I definitely have music that comes in for us.
Did you have a music connection with him when he was alive? Like, is he part of your influence for music?
He's an influence for sure. And he loved music. And that always like connects me back to him. I have a lot of like physical, like I wear certain jewelry that's very much like a physical totem for me for like different things. I don't know. I think I see things, I can kind of make a spiritual metaphor out of everything. And that's like a blessing and a curse because I'm just constantly seeing connections to things and reminders of things. And sometimes they're reminders for me and sometimes they're reminders for like a client that I'm working with. But I definitely am a believer that you can ask for signs of what you want. And you can be really specific about, you know, I want to see a rainbow today. I've seen a lot of rainbows for my dad too. You know, I want to see a rainbow today. You know, or I think that I might want to leave my job and I'm really looking for evidence that like that's the right thing for me. And I want to see that in the form of like hearing the song.
So you, it's
in the next 48 hours. Like you can be real specific
about like
with that.
What the sign has to be.
About what the sign should be. Yeah. I want to see a bluebird. I want to see.
Wow.
And then but the other part of that is that you then have to be looking.
Right.
But I think because of, you know, a byproduct of what I do for a living, I'm just sort of always looking and seeing other people's signs and translating those. And so,
but I love the idea of you have to ask the question. I say that sometimes in my class too. I'm like, we don't ask the questions. So you're not going to get the answers.
Yeah.
You got to actually be willing to ask the questions.
And oh, by the way, like from my experience, I don't usually hear those answers when I ask the question and I always ask them in meditation.
Right, it comes later
and it comes from a song or a billboard or a rainbow or a text that I get or the thing that pops up that shouldn't have popped up or, and that's the beauty of being present, is that you are instantly connected to like these minuscule, synchronistic, like energetic nuggets. And the more that you practice noticing them and engaging with them, the more you can harness that, those meaningful coincidences, that synchronistic energy, and like get shit done in your life so much faster.
I love it.
That like path of least resistance is very real.
We make it
so much harder than
we do.
The things,
we're our own worst enemies.
I say this in the book, like the things that on paper, and I say this all the time to people, the things that on paper seem really impressive took the least amount of effort. It took the most amount of me like trusting and surrendering and being detached from what I think is best. You know, it took the most amount of internal alignment and work and consistency with that, but the least amount of external, like organizing and engaging with these things and putting things in place. I didn't put anything in place to get a book deal.
Amazing. That's, you know, such a beautiful message.
Or getting
for
a
people.
Job for Deepak with no like experience in wellness without ever applying
right,
to
it was
work
just,
for
it's
Deepak.
It's where you were supposed to be.
I didn't even apply to work for, you know, it's just, it supported the underlying why. And I got out of the way of everything else.
And you let
listened,
it happen.
And listened and like picked up that first spiritual breadcrumb that I got. And was like, oh, okay, let's go this direction.
So we all need to be a little more Hansel and Gretel and pick up more breadcrumbs.
Pick up more spiritual breadcrumbs. And don't wait till you have 37 to be like, oh, maybe this is where I should be going.
That's right? Also true. Like, I feel like people need a lot of convincing.
Yeah, pick up like three and like surrender into that path and see what that feels like.
That, okay, on that we're doing it for years because that's powerful and amazing. And it's so true because we fight ourselves and I feel like we need a lot of convincing to do something that it's like, how many times can someone slap you in the face?
Right. And then you lose an organ and then, you know.
Right, exactly. And then it's like something awful happens.
And it's like, oh, maybe something's wrong. Right?
So true. Okay, so four quick questions, four takeaways. Do you journal or have a daily practice? I know you have a daily practice, but do you journal? Are you a journaler?
I don't daily journal anymore. I did a lot of journaling when I was young. I do a lot of voice memos, though.
Huh.
I'll record myself. If I have like a thought, a download, if you will, I'll do
smart.
A lot of those. Mm-hmm. You can transcribe it for free on Apple.
I should do that because I'm not a journaler either.
Yeah, I always really want
like to
be. I love the idea of being
a
consistent journaler.
I mean, with a nice worn like journal and like
and pen, like
cup of coffee. By the way, I don't drink coffee either. But the whole idea around the whole
thing. Whole thing. It's real vibey.
I agree.
Yeah, but no, I don't.
It was never me. What's the first thing you do when you wake up?
First thing I do when I wake up, aside from like the, you know, physiological things, I usually work out first and then I meditate.
What's your go-to workout?
I'm taking this precision running class, this like very intense interval running class.
Oh my God.
And I like to box and I like to spin.
All right. I like it.
And then like some like weight training. I've been really on my like workout grind this year.
I was going to say you're very well-rounded with your physical.
Yeah. That's usually given my like, my dream morning would be that. And then coming home, meditating, and then having, well, I can't drink coffee right now, but having like a tea or a coffee. And like in a very leisurely morning.
That sounds amazing.
I like love a leisurely morning.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, I love
Who
a leisurely
doesn't?
Morning.
I would love to have a leisurely morning. What's your guilty pleasure?
Oh, man. I don't feel guilty about too many pleasures, if we're being honest. My guilty pleasure, I've recently started ordering a lot of things on Amazon. Like, I ordered a lipstick on Amazon.
I order everything on Amazon. And I know it's not allowed anymore, quote-unquote.
I really enjoy, it's not allowed. I really enjoy, like, browsing Amazon lately. I don't feel great about that because it's not the most productive thing. Also,
I totally understand.
Yeah, it's not great. I also go and get, hot food from Erewhon, which is, like, the bougiest L.A. store, if any of you are listening, not in L.A., like, $20 overpriced for every single thing you could get. That's a guilty pleasure. Like, I can make food. I'm a good cook. But I will go and pick up food.
Amazon's one for me, too. It's just, and I know everyone's like, it's the worst thing in the world. But it makes your life so easy.
It's so easy. And I will, to circle back, I will binge watch a show.
I mean, I was going to say.
And I don't feel great about that.
I love it.
I enjoy it. But I really enjoy it.
And my problem with my binge watching, which I do a lot of because I love TV, is I get to the point it becomes like have to finish it.
Yeah.
So then it's more like I'm putting in the time to get it done so I can make more time for other things.
Right.
So I'm like, I need this over so I can now move on.
So I can now live my life.
It's horrible. It's like takes over. Okay. If you, I don't know if you have any, but if you were going to get a tattoo this week.
I have several.
Ooh. Mm. Well, then I want to know about the ones you have. Yeah. But if you were going to get a new one this week, what would it be?
It's so funny. I was thinking about, so I have my dad's handwriting on my arm.
He had nice handwriting.
Jesus
right?
Christ. Thanks, Daddy. I took, it says love always, and it was off of a really meaningful card he wrote me. So I brought that into the thing. And I've thought about, this week, I thought about getting the dad, like, added to it.
I kind of love that.
So I was thinking about that, so maybe you're my sign.
There you go.
I should go do it. And then I've
never asked anyone that question.
Oh, really?
So
yeah. I got my first tattoo two of them with my dad. My dad and I got our first tattoos together.
Aww.
I was 17. I made a whole presentation for my parents about why I wanted to get a tattoo and why I would always care about it and why it was the best thing that I could get. On the lower
tramp
back.
Stamp.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a little higher than a tramp stamp, like a suggestive stamp. And he got one with me. My mom went to the Treasure Island next door while we were getting that done.
Oh my God, I love
it's
you
like
guys.
It's so Jersey.
Love it.
And I got one on the back of my neck. Those are both like Irish knots, like Celtic tattoos.
And do you still like your first one?
No, I don't
see,
like
I
my
know.
First
it's
one.
A hard age.
This is the one on my arm is the only one I would keep.
Because it actually is meaningful to you.
Because I love it. And I love it aesthetically. The other ones are like, not my,
but that's the thing. At that age, you're not. It's so funny because I actually had the wherewithal. So I wanted one too, and I was like, "I'm gonna hate this when I'm older. I'm gonna hate this when I'm older." And I didn't do it.
That's
I'm
so
actually,
smart.
I know, I'm impressed with myself in hindsight.
My dad was like, "Yes, and I'll get one too,"
because he wanted
yeah,
one. That's so funny.
One.
But it is true, and it's that thing you can't tell a 17-year-old no. But you do want to be like, I have nothing against tattoos, but chances are you're gonna be annoyed. Yeah. This is on your skin in like 10 years.
I usually make myself want it for like a year. Like, I made myself really want this one for a while.
That's how I got mine. I never thought I'd want any tattoos.
Yeah.
And then I was just drawing it on myself every day.
Oh, yeah.
So once I drew it on myself for a year, I was like, you're good. You can put
like
it on you.
Like, you still want it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And by the way, the guy did such a shitty job. It looks like I still draw it on myself.
See,
it's like missing like ink and it's like blotchy and stuff. But I actually have never changed it because part of me is like, you know what? That's exactly what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I was drawing it. So let it be
we
the drawing.
We can make it really spiritually significant. Life,
is
not consistent. Life is about completing the circle, knowing
well, that's
that
what it
the
was for me.
Isn't going to be,
It was about truth for me.
Yeah.
So it's exactly that. Truth
is not
in,
neat. Truth is fucking
neat.
Messy sometimes, just like your tattoo.
So I do. There you go. I love it. You can make a spiritual metaphor out of anything. Amazing. You are awesome. She's going to do her personal practice, and lucky us, it's going to be a presence meditation, which is what we were talking about, 5 to 10 minutes. But you are so fun to have on here. We'll have to have you back.
I know. I had so much fun.
Great. No, you're great. And it's like you are literally just super real. And I mean, I hate always using the word authentic, but it is because it's a little overplayed, don't you think?
Yeah.
But it is very true with what it, I mean, it's a hard word.
But this
word.
Time
hard,
she means it, you
I
guys.
Do mean it. But it's a hard word to replace because it says exactly what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
But you are very authentic.
Oh,
and
thanks.
It's great. And I love the jersey in you.
It's there.
It is.
Deep.
It's hard to lose our jersey.
It's never gone.
I'm very proud of my jersey.
Yeah, it's never gone.
But thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. So now Megan's going to lead us in her personal practice, which is a presence meditation.
All right. So getting into whatever position feels the most comfortable for you right now. Once you've done that, go ahead and gently close your eyes. And we'll start by taking a few deep breaths together. Long, slow inhale through the nose. Open mouth, audible exhale. Again, long, slow inhale. Exhaling everything out through your mouth. One more deepest inhale yet. Pausing at the top of that breath for four, for three, for two. Seeing if you can't sip in a little more air and sighing everything out. And allowing that breath to become natural and relaxed, moving in and out through your nose. And we'll take this first minute or so to fully arrive here, knowing that your mind is often in a very different place from your physical body. Beginning to notice what you notice. Notice any sounds you hear. Notice what you can feel with your physical body. The air on your skin. The points of contact where your hands are resting. Maybe you can sense your heartbeat. Maybe you begin to notice where you feel that breath in your body. Allowing yourself to already begin to settle into that witnessing awareness. That space where you get to simply notice what you notice without getting involved, without deciding how you feel about it. That space where you have endless opportunities to rest in what is, with complete acceptance, with complete non-judgment. And so beginning to check in with yourself, how are you feeling physically? Ask the question and notice what you notice with complete acceptance and non-judgment. How are you feeling mentally? Ask the question. Notice what you notice with complete acceptance and non-judgment. How are you feeling emotionally? Ask the question and notice what you notice with complete acceptance and non-judgment. Resting completely in where you are and who you are right now. And then begin to invite in the silent and gentle repetition of the mantra, so hum, so hum. If your mind is feeling turbulent, you can link that mantra with your breath as you inhale, silently repeat so. As you exhale, hum. Knowing that it is in the nature of your mind to wander, when you notice that you've drifted to another thought, to a sound, to a sensation in your body, with that same detachment and acceptance, notice where your mind has gone and gently bring yourself back. So hum. So hum. Notice where your mind is. Continue to come back. So hum. And with your eyes remaining closed, gently releasing the repetition of the mantra. Beginning to once again notice your inhale and exhale, that physical sensation that always anchors you back to this present moment. Begin to notice as well that space, however brief, that exists after you exhale, before you take that next breath in. Notice the space between your breath after you exhale, before you take that next breath in, notice the pure presence that resides in that space, the stillness. And the ever-present opportunity to retreat into that space and take a break, to notice what you notice, and to decide how you want to be and who you want to be in that next moment, in that next breath. And so with all that in mind, with that intention to continue to come back to your present moment and to proceed with intention, taking one final deep breath in, once again pausing at the top, exhaling everything out, surrendering all of the details over, trusting in this moment that you have done absolutely everything that you need to do. Letting your breath gradually begin to deepen as it carries you back into the space that you're sitting in, back into your body, where it feels comfortable inviting in some subtle movement, letting all of your senses come back online and wake back up. And when you're ready, in your own time, allowing your eyes to float open gently.
Dentalk's podcast would not exist without these incredible people: Nicole Rappi, Reem Edon, Hayden Fungheiser, Kim Bielek, and music by Alex Fetter. Thanks for joining us. If you haven't subscribed, please do. And also, wherever you listen, please go and leave us a review. It's so greatly appreciated. It really does help us out. If you want to keep talking about all this stuff, please join our community on our secret Facebook page. Go to Facebook, search Dentalk's podcast, and join us there.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health, or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.